This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Now that the presidential primaries are underway, there are new political polling results just about every day. Is polling good or bad for democracy? That question frames the article Jill Lepore recently wrote in The New Yorker called Politics and the New Machine. She reports that polling may never have been less reliable or more influential than it is now. She writes, from the late 1990s to 2012, 1,200 polling organizations conducted nearly 37,000 polls by making more than 3 billion phone calls. Most Americans refused to speak with them. Lepore is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a professor of American history at Harvard University. Later, we'll hear from Nate Silver, founder of the popular website 538, which analyzes political polls and predicts outcomes. Jill Lepore, welcome to Fresh Air. So, you know, you write in your article that polls may be more influential than ever. You also write that you think polls may be less reliable than ever. A typical response rate to polls is in the single digits. Less than 10% of people who are asked to respond to a poll actually follow through and respond.
Yeah, isn't that a little staggering to think about?
Is it the low single digits or the high single digits?
There's a range. I think 9 is not uncommon. I mean, it can be very much at the high end of the range. I think that to know whether that's a crisis or not requires understanding what pollsters do or what public opinion researchers do more broadly. They use a sample survey method. So they conduct interviews with what is supposed to be a statistically representative sample of the electorate. That sample is going to be tiny, and the sample works to represent all of our views as an electorate, so long as it is well chosen. Choosing that sample is harder when the response rate is lower. When public opinion survey research started in the 1930s, the response rate was well above 90. People considered it a civic duty. It was like a thrill. Someone would come knock on your door and want to talk to you for 45 minutes about politics. Now, I think someone calls you at 6:01 p.m. and wants to talk to you about politics while you're trying to get the chicken fried. You hang up the phone. There are a whole bunch of forces that are behind that. There's just a fatigue. There's so many pollsters. And then there's just people don't have landlines anymore. I think it's only 40% of Americans have landlines. And you can't do random dialing to cell phones. The FCC made that rule, and they recently reinforced it. And then you have the problem of the people who answer the phone are really different from a random sampling of the electorate, right? The people who answer the phone tend to be older. They tend to be more conservative. Those are the people who have landlines. And then the people who answer the phone and are going to really participate in your survey, they tend to be people who have a very strong sense of civic obligation and they're involved in their communities. They tend to be voters. You know, they're very good-hearted, civic-minded people, and they're overrepresented unless you work harder to represent the smaller number of people you can get who are not those people. So pre-election polling in particular is just in crisis. So, you know, what pollsters will say, because pollsters want to get the right answer, right? It's not actually a fraudulent industry. Their bread and butter is making an accurate prediction. They will say they can accommodate and moderate the ill effect of a very low response rate by weighting their responses and by doing more calling. And so that means polls get more expensive. And the results don't really bear out those promises. So there's this whole other kind of cottage industry in trying to figure out which polls might be reliable.
So if the people who actually respond to polls are older, they're more civic-minded, they're more likely to be a churchgoer, what's the population of people who are less likely to respond to polls? In other words, who's being left out of the polls?
The representative sample in a poll should represent the possible eligible voters. What happens with a really low response rate is that the representative sample in a poll represents the likeliest voters. That is to say, the people who are most likely to answer a poll are also most likely to vote. So this, for pre-election polls, where really what you're trying to do is figure out what's going to happen in an election, in fact, in some ways, the low response rate makes those polls more likely to be accurate, right? Because it's a big problem of predicting an election. You can get people to tell you who they might vote for, but you can't tell whether they're going to vote or not. But actually, the bigger question then is, well, isn't that actually completely inimical to representative democracy? Like, should we really be, then we're disenfranchising everybody who doesn't answer the poll. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many forms of disenfranchisement in our political culture, and polls have, in a weird and completely unintentional way, become yet another one of them. So in a world of widening political inequality and economic inequality, polls have become, you know, they're just riding that same wave.
Let's talk a little bit about polling history. You write that pollsters rose to prominence by claiming that measuring public opinion is good for democracy. What is that argument, and who first made it?
That argument was made in the 1930s by George Gallup, who founded the first public opinion polling research institution in Princeton, New Jersey in 1935. And before Gallup began conducting his public opinion surveys, there really weren't polls in anything like we know them today. Polls, they're so ubiquitous, it's easy to forget that there was a time before there were polls. Like, people are always calling elections. Like, you know, it would be the 1828 election and between Jackson and John Quincy Adams, and people would be like, I wonder who's going to win. I think I know who's going to win. And you might even go around to your precinct and ask people, knock on their doors, or like, who are you voting for? Go down to the bar and who are you voting for? Try to make a guess and decide maybe where to put more resources if you were running for office. But doing what Gallup did, which is using the sample survey method of social science, which was new at the time, to predict elections, was only really done by him in the 1930s. Gallup actually wanted to be a journalist. He wanted to be a newspaper editor. But when he was in college, there was no journalism program, so he studied psychology instead, and then he went and got a PhD in psychology. But think about the 1930s then, when he starts doing this and saying, you know what, public opinion, elections come only every 2 years, but we, in this fast-moving world, he said, we need to be able to measure public opinion every minute, instantly. We need to know the will of the people. And part of the reason for that was a tremendous anxiety in the 1930s about basically the kind of demagoguery that Americans feared that the radio, here I am talking to you on the radio, might be introducing. Radio was greeted with great celebration, but it was also very gravely feared. I mean, the War of the Worlds is just a few years after George Gallup founds the American Institute for Public Opinion. Public opinion, it can be contorted by a voice coming into your living room and telling you what to think, and that's how fascism grew in Europe. So a countervailing method that would go the opposite direction from the broadcast of a radio would be to actually call somebody or go to their door and ask them what they think and have them tell you. And then you would report that. That is, you could turn the radio upside down, and that this would be the way democracy could fight fascism. Almost in this kind of very mechanical way. But Gallup, when he started out, he wanted to measure what he called public opinion. That is, the views that ordinary Americans held. He actually didn't want to forecast elections or conduct polls, pre-election polls. He was doing opinion surveys. But he found that no one really believed his opinion survey results, because how are you going to check that? Like, 47% of Americans believe in God. Well, I don't know, says George Gallup. Why should I believe George Gallup? I mean, obviously he made a bunch of phone calls. I don't know. So to prove that his method was accurate, that he was actually measuring something real, he started asking people how they were going to vote so that he could then predict an election. So this is basically as a stunt in order to convince people that his public opinion research had teeth. And then he found, kind of, I think, somewhat he was disheartened to find, people loved these predictions. They, you know, people eat that stuff. Obviously, we do. People love to read election predictions. And so that more or less took on a life of its own. But he really didn't defend that as good for democracy. He defended public opinion measurement as good for democracy.
You know, there are so many newspapers and TV stations and radio stations and other media outlets who sponsor their own polls now. When did that proliferation in polling start to catch on?
It really started in the 1970s. So for a long time, Gallup was the poller. There was also Roper, and then the Harris poll followed soon after. So there's significant, and almost the way they're kind of, you know, the network television stations, there's the kind of the big three. They were the big three for a long time, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And then there grew to be a lot of concern about what seemed to be the proliferation of smaller polling organizations, so much so that in 1972, Congress debated a Truth in Polling Act because they wanted to help voters discriminate between good polls and bad polls. And the act didn't pass. And then in 1975, the New York Times and CBS, I believe, collaborated on the first basically, you know, major newspaper poll. And it's been off to the races ever since. I've, you know, talked about this piece on like a local radio station here in Boston, and that local radio station had just launched its own polling collaboration with a local college. And I said, like, how do you justify that? Like, in the 1970s, people said, you're actually creating news and your job is to report news. But it was tremendously profitable for those newspapers and those television stations and radio stations to pay for polls to be done in order to report those polls. I think the proliferation most recently, like in the last 10 years, the number of those kind of smaller organizations, small colleges, for instance, that get into this industry, smaller radio stations, smaller town newspapers, like I think the Union Leader in New Hampshire has his own pollster. That is actually about the incredible shrinking sources of deep journalism. So it's about the crisis of newspapers and the crisis of news more generally with the rise of the internet and kind of niche reporting. It's very cheap to conduct a poll relative to doing the kind of deep reporting that would be required to actually get some sense of an electorate and report in a using something other than pure quantification.
So everybody pays so much attention for so long to Iowa, to predicting what the outcome of the Iowa caucuses will be, and then reporting on the outcome, and then trying to read the tea leaves to predict what the outcome of the election is going to be. And I realize that in Iowa, it's caucuses, it's not primaries. But, you know, in America, we pride ourselves on having a secret ballot. You go to the voting booth. People aren't allowed to give you campaign literature within a certain number of feet of the polling booth. You go in, you close the curtain, you vote. No one knows what you vote unless you tell them. It's your decision whether you want to tell anybody or not. You're under no obligation to. In the Iowa caucuses, you're in a gym or something. You're in a room. Everybody who's there knows what you're doing because you're telling them, or you're walking to a side of the room to indicate what you're doing. And there's something about it that just seems so counter to the idea of it's an American democracy with a secret ballot. There's such possibility for like peer pressure, for intimidation, for like wanting to go with the crowd, you know, not wanting to go along with your spouse or your best friend.
It's so funny that you would have a kind of suspicion that that's somehow anti-American, but that polling, which is of course a version of that, right? Like that bandwagon effect, wouldn't necessarily leap out at you in that same way. But in fact, the secret ballot is a latecomer in American political culture. It isn't really adopted. The first presidential election where the secret ballot is the preponderant mode of voting is 1896, which is also the first presidential election which someone is not killed on election day. No, voting in public is far more ancient and more American in that sense. So the whole idea of being a good citizen requires publicly exercising your franchise. So people, you would go to the polls and you would, the government didn't supply a ballot. You would write, you know, first you'd have to, first, they were all viva voce. You'd basically be like a caucus. You go to the polling place and be like, okay, if you are voting for Smith, stand over here against the butchers. And if you're in favor of Jones, stand over there down by the library. And that's how the votes would be made. And the polls would be counted. That poll means the top of your head. So people would count the tops of people's heads. And that's why it was called the polls. So the call to reform public voting, or what was known as open voting, was super controversial because Massachusetts was the first to do it. And they had this idea that the government would supply these envelopes and you could bring, so people would start, when the party system got really strong and newspapers were partisan, like the Republicans would print a ballot, like a whole party ticket. It would be like, say, it's red. And the Democratic newspaper would print a blue party ticket. And so you go to the town hall. This is when oral voting had kind of been replaced by paper voting because people were literate. But still, you'd have this giant long sheet, like a railway ticket, like 2 foot long, that would be brightly colored. And so people would try to prevent you from getting to the ballot box and casting your vote. The parties would hire these thugs to go down there, Democratic thugs, say, to beat up all the Republicans with their blue tickets and prevent them. Well, people would die. People killed every election in these incredible battles over trying to get to the. Then there was this thing called vest pocket voting. So this was a little bit sneakier. If you wanted to keep your vote private, you'd fold up your long, you know, blue ticket and you'd stick it in your vest pocket and try to get to the polls without anybody, you know, knocking you on that. But this was considered unmanly. So when Massachusetts in the 1850s tried to say, well, we'll just supply envelopes and people can put their tickets in the envelopes before they come to the ballot box, it would have repealed because people said that only cowards would use an envelope to vote. You know, so it was a really controversial thing. It takes years for the secret ballot to be adopted. And it's part of actually a lot of forces that are not, that people wanted to, didn't realize there's a lot of corruption, right? There's all kinds of party machine nonsense. People are being beat up. That's obviously not good. Also, women wanted the right to vote, and they were like, if we don't, we would need to vote in secret. We don't want to get hit in the head. So suffragists were sort of supporting the secret ballot. But it was first passed in Massachusetts and New York in the 1880s. But then for years, the only other places that adopted the secret ballot, which is a written ballot supplied by the government to each voter, was the South after Reconstruction, because it was a way to disenfranchise newly enfranchised black men who none of them knew how to read. I mean, they'd been, you know, raised in slavery, lived their entire lives as slaves on plantations. And so it was the real success of the secret ballot as a national political institution had to do with the disenfranchisement of black men.
So the secret ballot was a way of helping them get the vote?
No, it was preventing them from voting. If you could cut your ballot out of the newspaper and you were going to vote a party ticket and you knew you wanted to vote Republican and that ticket was going to be red, you didn't have to know how to read to vote. Immigrants could vote. Newly enfranchised black men in the South could vote.
Mm-hmm.
It actually was a big part of expanding the electorate. But people in the North were like, hey, we don't really like when all those immigrants vote. And people in the South were like, we really don't want these black guys to vote. So they, in a sense, kind of colluded over. There were good reasons for the secret ballot, too, but they very much motivated by making it harder for people who are illiterate to vote. It's essentially a de facto literacy test.
Because in the polling place, like in the election booth, it wouldn't be like code colored like that, or you couldn't ask anybody to read it to you. Is that what you're saying?
You couldn't. Right. And so, like, there's some counties in Virginia, I think it is, that in the 1890s, they print some regular ballots, but then they print ballots in Gothic type, like deep medieval Gothic type, and they give all those ballots to the black men. It's a completely illegible ballot. So anyway, people debated it a lot of the time for those reasons. And also, I mean, you think about it, why does Congress vote in open? Well, if you're a congressperson, your vote should be known to the public. That's part of transparency that we believe in. It seems obvious to us. People believe that way about ordinary citizens voting as well, for a long, long time. So the caucus in Iowa, that method, which is so kooky and kind of fascinating, but that's deliberative democracy. That is a certain kind of exercise of civic virtue that needs to be conducted in public.
So I am stunned by everything you have just told me, because I thought the secret ballot was one of the principles American democracy was built on. Did you always know this, or did you find that out later in life?
No, I totally didn't know it. I always have to find things out because I just get curious about them. Remember the election with the Florida, the ballot, the chat, hanging chat and everything. So I was asked to write a piece about voting machines or technologies in voting, because we were looking like we're maybe moving to internet voting. And I thought, I don't know, that's a voting, going from paper voting to internet voting doesn't seem that big of a deal. But what's a really big deal would be going from oral voting to paper voting. I wonder what that was like. And so then I did all this research and realized that, oh, the secret ballot is just such an incredible latecomer. And it's the whole story of its origins utterly shocked me and was really illuminating, because it made me think about how Victorian our voting is. Do you know what I mean? It's like, go in this little booth with a little curtain and you got to be alone. It's going to be dainty and private. It is actually a kind of Victorian domestic, quiet, sacred, middle-class space, and that was carved out by middle-class reformers, you know, against the kind of hurly-burly of, you know, the rowdy, exciting, drunken voting day.
So here's another American history question for you. It always seems that the presidential campaign gets longer and longer and longer. And I don't even mean the permanent campaign where after you win the election, you're campaigning immediately for re-election. I just mean like the relentless press coverage of the horse race. It seems longer and longer each presidential election. So if we look back historically, how much time was devoted to the actual campaigning?
So campaigning used to be considered completely gauche. So there was no presidential campaigning at all until Andrew Jackson. So people thought if you actually tried to convince the people to vote for you, that you were a demagogue, that you should be such an esteemed man in society that everyone would know who you are and would be familiar with your accomplishments and let it to them to decide. This is very kind of courtly notion. Now, this is a very small electorate of, you know, propertied white men. They're only people who can vote anyway. Those people do know who you are. How you get to run is to do with, you know, your party nominates you in this completely closed proceeding. Andrew Jackson comes along. Andrew Jackson is not a natural candidate.
What year are we talking here?
1824. He's not a founding father, and he's not a son of a founding father. And everybody who'd been president though so far had been either a founding father or a founding son. And he's kind of like an orphan, brutal soldier guy. But he's famous for this battle. And I'm going to start campaigning. And he hires a biographer to write the story of his life. It's the first campaign biography. And then he starts, like, talking to people. You know, he invites people when he's inaugurated. He invites, like, ordinary people to come see him be inaugurated. I mean, this is the beginning of so much of our political culture can be traced to Jackson. So then there's this great age of campaigning. But it is absolutely last minute. Most of it is you got to have someone write your biography about it, maybe a year in advance. You get those books out. And then you got to buy a lot of whiskey and you got to go. There's like when people become the log cabin candidates, the Whig Party, they hire these like rolling log cabins. And like, yeah, William Henry Harrison, I think, campaigns in these rolling log cabins, like John McCain's bus tour or something. So there's a bunch of campaigning in the 19th century. In fact, it retracts in the 20th century because... Wilson is the first guy to like have a record. Harding maybe has a record. He cuts an album of his campaign speech. So he's like, I'm not going to travel. Like I could travel by railroad. I'll just do these, you know, whistle stops. But there's this sort of weird retraction. Or FDR, you know, he does newsreels. He's the first newsreel president from 1932. He uses newsreels. So there's a kind of remoteness almost. The campaign stretches in time, but the candidate becomes more remote from the people, which is in some ways what the caucuses and primary movement is about, right? Getting these candidates to actually come to your states.
Yeah, maybe FDR did the newsreels because of his polio.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But then by then, by 1932, that's the first newsreel. 1933 is the first political consulting firm, this Campaigns, Inc. They start using the radio. And... they will come into your living room and they will tell you should never vote for FDR. The man will doom the country. You know what I mean? Like they have this whole other, they have actually an amplifier.
Right. And that gets to where we started, which is,
yeah.
Is that public polling was seen as a way to combat radio because through strangers coming into your home and telling you who to vote for, it could lead to fascism. But if we had public polling, the public opinion would be represented and you wouldn't be relying on that voice intruding.
Yeah, the voice of the people is the answer to propaganda.
Right. Okay. Jill Lepore, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Terry's been a blast.
Jill Lepore's article about whether polling is good or bad for democracy was published in The New Yorker.